So while we're getting set for the second and last session, let me just introduce while trying to find the cable.
There.
The next speaker, which is Patakai Baga from one of our sponsors, actually, Sarmiento. And she's been to the last interaction in Savannah just this, what was it?
February, right.
And this time in precisely 20 slides and 20 seconds will give us her impressions of Interaction 10. There you go.
Ja, hallo. Birgit, wie gesagt, mein Name. Ich bin UX-Designerin und Visual-Designerin hier in Hamburg. Ich werde versuchen, in diesem wirklich kurzen Format ein bisschen Eindruck zu geben, was ich auf der Interaction 10 erlebt habe. Also erstmal so ein bisschen den Rahmen. Es war in Savannah, sondern 500 Attendees. Jetzt mische ich Englisch-Deutsch. Es wurde alles aufgeteilt auf neuen Locations, also wirklich schöne Locations auch, also die haben wirklich für gute Atmosphäre gesorgt, wo wirklich viel Kreativität und Inspiration entstanden ist. Man konnte ohne weiteres von A nach B gehen, war wirklich gut organisiert, das Hauptlocation war ein Kino. Es drehte sich viel um diesen Kreis, den wir eigentlich kennen, also Design Development, was ist eigentlich Technik und Mensch und wie beeinflusst sich das alles und was ist eigentlich Meaning of Design, wie entsteht das und wie wird das dann auf Interaction und Behavior, wie wirkt sich das aus und wie dann wieder auf das Design. Also es ist jeder einzelne von diesen Bereichen wurde in vielen Facetten angeguckt, also nicht einfach nur, okay, Meaning of Design, einfach nur für Design, sondern Meaning selber, auch nochmal, was das für uns Designer eigentlich bedeutet. Technology and New Developments wurde angeguckt, sowohl natürlich neue Geräte, also was es alles so draußen gibt, auch die Tables und an Interaction Design und Ähnlichem. Es gab aber auch Technologien wie eben Realtime, also was bedeutet das eigentlich für uns und welche Auswirkungen hat das für die Interaktion und welche Auswirkungen hat das für das Design und für das Konzept. Und die 20 Sekunden müssten schon lange um sein, oder komme ich mir das vor? So, also, und das war eigentlich ganz spannend, also auch nochmal diesen Schritt zurückzugehen und zu sagen, okay, wir gewöhnen uns zwar alle an Realtime und die Erwartungshaltung, die sich dadurch eigentlich ändert, aber was bedeutet das eigentlich für Interaktionen und was bedeutet das auch für Businessmodelle, also wie Google zum Beispiel? Wie können Sie das vernünftig so sortieren? Was bedeutet sowas für Suche? Ich gehe da gleich nochmal ein bisschen drauf ein. Also Augmented Reality war natürlich auch ein Thema, wo auch eine hervorragende Präsentation war, wo ich auch gleich noch ein bisschen was zu sagen werde. Ja, schauen wir mal. Ich schummel, ist mir egal. Es wurde viel über Mensch gesprochen. Empathie war irgendwie so ein Stichwort, wie früher irgendwann mal Interaktion oder Experience. Also es gibt ja immer irgendwie so eine Phase von Schlagwörtern. Empathie war diesmal eins. Empathie aber in Form von, okay, was bedeutet eigentlich das für einen Benutzer so, wie kann man empathisch werden, aber auch was sind das für Grenzen, die wir da eigentlich haben und was für Einflüsse können wir eigentlich nehmen als Designer, je empathischer wir sind, was können wir bewirken und da wurde auch ein bisschen drüber diskutiert, okay, was sind da eigentlich die Grenzen, also wie weit können wir da gehen, also wo ist dann wieder die Technik, wo wird es auch creepy, wenn man irgendwie zu empathisch wird. Also wie vereinigt man das eigentlich? Also wir haben jetzt vorhin auch wieder gehört, wir müssen immer den Menschen in den Mittelpunkt stellen, aber es wurde halt auch viel darüber diskutiert, okay, was heißt das eigentlich? Also das ist mittlerweile, klar, wir sagen das immer irgendwie, Mensch muss im Mittelpunkt sein. Und das bedeutet aber für jeden Einzelnen eigentlich auch was komplett anderes. Also weil jeder Mensch auch ein Individuum ist, der seine eigenen Gedanken an den Tisch bringt und ich glaube, das läuft nicht, mache ich es einfach so, ist mir auch eh lieber. Meaning of Design. Meaning, die Bedeutung von Design, ein bisschen, was ich eben schon sagte, also was können wir eigentlich bewirken, aber auch viele Diskussionen darüber, als Designer, welchen Einfluss wir eigentlich haben und ob wir uns diesen Einfluss und diese Macht, die wir auch als Designer haben, ob wir uns dieser Verantwortung auch bewusst sind. Und wie wir diesen Einfluss in unsere Arbeit, in unsere Methoden einbringen können und auch da, wo sind eigentlich da Grenzen gesetzt? Also es wird teilweise, der John Colco geht so weit, dass er eben auch ganz klar sagt, und ich unterstütze ihn da auch, mit gutem Design kann man eben auch eine Gesellschaft verändern. Also je nachdem, wie man da rangeht und was man macht, dass man da eben weitere Veränderungen einfügen kann, die man vielleicht so gar nicht erwartet. So wie zu John. John hat eine Keynote gehalten, die ich empfehle, definitiv. Alle Videos, Side Note, alle Videos werden irgendwann dargestellt. Ich packe es auf Twitter, wenn sie da sind, und vielleicht ein kleiner Eindruck jetzt hier, welche für euch interessant sein könnten. John war auf jeden Fall sehr spannend, weil er viele Sachen auch in Frage gestellt hat. Also er sagt eben auch nicht nur einfach Empathie, sondern ihm geht es eben auch um Individuen. Also er sagt eben auch, dass man mit dem Wort Experience ganz vorsichtig umgehen soll. Also jeder redet von, wir müssen gute Experience entwickeln, aber was heißt das eigentlich? Und dass wir uns eben auch bewusst sind, dass jeder Einzelne immer eine andere Experience hat, mit egal was wir designen. Also wenn wir sagen, wir wollen jetzt eine gute Experience designen, das bedeutet für jeden Einzelnen, der hier sitzt, einfach was anderes, also wie er es auch erlebt, weil man sich eben als Individuum komplett mit quasi, wie sagt man, bring on the table. Und da hat er relativ viel drüber geredet und hat das wirklich gut aufgebaut. Die Alexis Lloyd von dem Research Lab von der New York Times, die hat sich das Web eigentlich mal angeguckt, natürlich auch von der Nachrichten- und Content-Bereich, und hat ganz klar gesagt, okay, das Web teilt sich jetzt auf. Also früher war es eben Veröffentlichungsmedium. Der Mensch ist hingegangen, hat sich Informationen geholt. Und heute ist es eher Kommunikation. Der Mensch steht auch hier im Mittelpunkt und bekommt Informationen von diversen Online-Medien, aber auch immer mehr, auch zukunftsweisend, immer mehr Geräten. Also irgendwann wird die Waschmaschine dir das Wetter vorlesen, so ungefähr. Also sie geht da sehr zukunftsweisend ran und stellt eben die Frage, was das bedeutet, also gerade Zeitungen, Verlage, denen geht es ja noch nicht sonderlich gut. Und sie hat auch die ganze Realtime-Thematik auch nochmal ein bisschen betont und hat eben gesagt, okay, diese Massen an Daten, die wir uns eigentlich alle ja jetzt holen oder die uns zur Verfügung stellen und an denen wir auch teilnehmen, also wir twittern, wir laden Daten hoch, wir haben Images, wie auch immer, das heißt, wir sind ein Teil davon und wir fangen an zu personalisieren, oder tun wir schon lange, teilweise unbewusst, teilweise bewusst. Aber für Verlage ist zum Beispiel das Problem, wie bringe ich eigentlich noch Editorial Content zu den Menschen? Weil das ist ja auch wichtig, dass mal irgendwas empfohlen wird und man sich quasi nicht so nur in seinem eigenen Kreis bewegt, sondern dass man auch Empfehlungen bekommt, inspiriert wird und von außen ein bisschen mehr Eindruck bekommt. Peter Morville hat über Suche natürlich gesprochen. Es war eigentlich auch eine sehr gute Präsentation. Er ist einmal durch die Geschichte der Suche gegangen, hat dann verschiedene Behavior und Design Patterns vorgestellt und anhand von ziemlich vielen Beispielen eigentlich nochmal so aufgezeigt, wie es funktioniert. Teilweise schon bekannt, hat natürlich ein bisschen Werbung für sein Buch gemacht, klar. Hat es aber eigentlich wirklich gut rübergebracht, auch die Unterschiede von Behavior Patterns und Design Patterns, und ist dann auch nochmal, also er ist auch sehr zukunftsweisend gewesen und hat dann nochmal gesagt, okay, wie läuft das eigentlich, wie ist das eigentlich zukünftig und wie ist das jetzt schon? Und unter anderem sagt er halt, okay, auch hier die Sinne, also auch hier wieder der Mensch und die Empathie, also wir werden immer mehr weiter anfangen, Sachen auch über Gefühle zu suchen oder über unsere Sinneswahrnehmung. Also für uns, dadurch, dass wir jetzt, sage ich mal, als Menschen, der einen Computer benutzt, immer mehr ja auch die Vermenschlichung eines Computers wahrnehmen, umso mehr haben wir auch automatisch diesen Anspruch, das ist jetzt meine Interpretation, diesen Anspruch, dass natürlich auch der Computer mich versteht als Mensch. Also sage ich natürlich auch, es fühlt sich an wie ein kleiner Puppy, irgendwie, ich suche das und das. Und dass das eben immer mehr kommt, und er hat ein paar Beispiele genannt, wo es eben schon da ist. Und das fand ich eigentlich auch sehr interessant. Ich habe einen Workshop gemacht mit Nokia, mit dem Raphael, sehr inspirierend. Also ich habe den John Chip Chase auch schon mal gesehen, der übrigens jetzt auf der Typo sein wird. Ich kann den nur empfehlen, das ist wirklich eine inspirierende Art, wie sie erzählen. Also der Designprozess ist halt dieses Double Diamond Diagram und danach richten sie sich ziemlich stark. In dem Workshop haben wir dann den ganzen Define-Bereich so gemacht. Also wir hatten diesen Discover, die hatten Projekte mit Adaptive Path und wir hatten dann Daten von da genommen und sind die durchgegangen und haben noch Opportunities gesucht. Und das war eigentlich sehr, sehr interessant. Ich kann Unterlagen dazu zur Verfügung stellen. Und dann ist er weitergegangen, hat eben auch nochmal aufgezeigt, wie sie wirklich vor Ort gehen. Also die machen viermal im Jahr so Field Trips. Und die sind dann alle so ein bisschen außerhalb, ist immer so ein Senior Designer dabei, drei Designer noch, der Rest ist mit Studenten vor Ort, es sind immer so um die 20.000 K, hat er gesagt, und Vorbereitung ungefähr einen Monat, dann sind sie 10 Tage vor Ort und teilweise eben wirklich in so abgelegenen Ecken, also hier ist wirklich die Menschen, die man da sieht, die leben da und er sitzt da an der Seite und macht sich Notizen und basierend darauf, suchen sie halt nach weiteren Möglichkeiten, wie ein Handy sinnvoll genutzt werden kann. Und das war und ist sehr inspirierend gewesen. Dann ging es um die Thematik Disabilities. Hier wurde der Bogen sehr gespannt. Oder er hat 6 Monate Recherche gemacht zwischen Disabilities und Virtual World. Also was wurde da eigentlich, wie ist da eigentlich eine Verbindung und was kann eigentlich die so Virtual Worlds, wofür wird das eigentlich genutzt? Also nicht nur für Entertainment, sondern für Community Building und eben auch Pflegen von sozialen Kontakten. Darüber redet er recht viel. Chris Fahey unbedingt angucken, großartige Präsentation, eines der absoluten Highlights. Also er hat jetzt an der Uncanny Valley, da hat er sich so ein bisschen den Faden gezogen und ganz genau geguckt, okay, diese Human Interface, wirklich wann wird es creepy? Unter anderem das Beispiel von hier Clippy mit reingebracht irgendwie, in einem Microsoft Clippy. Ab welchem Punkt ist er eigentlich creepy geworden und warum? Und ist dann weitergegangen und hat gesagt, okay, diese drei Worte, darum kann man das Human Interface, damit kann man das beschreiben. Und ist mit sehr vielen Beispielen, erklärt er das. Also Intimacy zum Beispiel, die Nähe zum Computer. Und da geht es nicht nur darum, dass man eben physisch dem Computer nahe ist, also sprich, ich bin Diabetiker und habe irgendein Gerät an meinem Körper, sondern auch die Nähe durch Kommunikation, die entsteht. Stichwort Twitter. Was bedeutet das eigentlich? Und ja, da geht er sehr interessant drauf ein. Das solltet ihr euch vielleicht mal auf Slideshare runterladen. Augmented Reality, auch spannender Vortrag, den ich, zumindest haben mir das alle erzählt, ich war nicht da oder nur die letzten 10 Minuten mitgekriegt. Er geht eigentlich mal durch die Reise, was ist das eigentlich, was kann man da, was gibt es für verschiedene Arten von Augmented Reality und was bedeutet das eigentlich und welche Arten von Augmented Reality haben wir eigentlich schon ganz normal in unser Leben integriert. Beim Football, er nimmt das Beispiel beim Football, dass da immer diese Linie eingeblendet wird im Fernsehen, dass das eben auch eine Art von Augmented Reality ist und wo hat es eigentlich Potenzial, aber was ich auch spannend fand, dass er eben auch sagte, okay, eine Problematik, die wir haben, ist unter anderem Privacy Issues und dass es eben noch überhaupt keine Design Patterns gibt. Ben fand ich sehr erfrischend. Ben hat eigentlich nochmal so ein bisschen auf die Pause-Taste gedrückt und hat was besonders angenehm war, weil 99,9% der Menschen, die da waren, hatten ein iPhone, ich eingeschlossen. Und wir saßen natürlich da und haben viel getwittert und viel geguckt und was wahnsinnig viel Aufmerksamkeit von den Präsentationen weggenommen hat. Und er stellt eigentlich auch nochmal so einen Raum, was tun wir uns eigentlich an und was tun wir den Menschen eigentlich an mit den Dingen, die wir kreieren und eben auch diese Erwartungshaltung, die dann da ist, immer connected zu sein. Also sich selber gegenüber und auch anderen gegenüber. Und er stellt eigentlich nochmal dar, wie gut es auch ist, wenn man einfach mal sagt, okay, ich bin nicht available. So, und dass man den Mut dazu auch haben sollte. In diesem Sinne, also wie ihr merkt, viele, viele Eindrücke. Es waren 60 Speaker. Ich hatte nicht im Ansatz die Chance, das weder alle zu sehen, noch auch nur im Ansatz irgendwie alles wiederzugeben. Ich kann definitiv sagen, es war eine der besten Konferenzen, auf denen ich je war, kostengünstig mit $750 und der Spirit, der da war, war gigantisch und man hatte die ganzen, keine Ahnung, Dan Seffers, Lou Rosenfelds der Welt da, die wirklich mit denen man einfach halt ein Bier getrunken hat und ganz interessante Gespräche geführt hat. Und ich fand den Tweet hier irgendwie sehr süß, wo er irgendwie schreibt, must ask my wife if there was a process floating bar above me. So, weil einfach, das ist so viel und nach diesen 4 Tagen bin ich auch zurückgekommen und war fertig. So, ja. Vielen Dank.
Vielen Dank für die beiden Pitcher-Kutscher-Freiwilligen. Es geht nicht darum, die Regeln sklavisch einzuhalten, von daher fand ich, das waren sehr, sehr spannende 2 Beiträge. Ein dritter war uns leider ausgefallen, aber da wir vorneweg ein bisschen länger gebraucht haben, sind wir jetzt fast wieder in der Zeit. Ich will nicht hetzen, sondern nur ein bisschen überbrücken, bis unser Gastredner, unser Abschlussgastredner aus Kopenhagen sich angeschlossen hat. Switch to English right now, because the screen is not really blue anymore. Well, in fact it is, but in a couple of seconds. There we go. So if you have visions, there are kind of 2 ways to deal with the situation. Number one, according to Helmut Schmidt, our former chancellor, you can go and see a doctor. Number two, you can go the way that Thomas prefers, that is becoming a practical visionary. And he's doing so for, well, at least a decade as far as Reboot goes. So Thomas is driving the Reboot conference for 10 years now. And apart from that, many, many other, little companies, big companies, startup companies, successful companies. There are probably some failures, but I don't know about them. So please be so kind to welcome Thomas Madsen-Bygdahl from Copenhagen.
Thanks a lot, Matthias. I'm going to do this in English with a slight of American accent. My teacher from school that gave me 6 years of German education will feel very bad. But I do understand a bit, but it's really far away at the moment, unfortunately. Thanks for inviting me, Matthias, for this magnificent venue and this magnificent event. Always great to see things. I've never imagined I'd had the opportunity to speak at an event called Spaceship Earth, but there you go. Life takes you in interesting directions always. What I'm just going to try and talk a bit about is rebooting. And it's actually the first time ever that I'm doing a presentation on rebooting, because I've always been hesitant about using the metaphor of reboot since I've been doing the Reboot Festival for 12 years. And for me, it's always been just a name, just a metaphor, just a framing. And you know, you shouldn't put too much emphasis on those. But it's sort of been growing on me the last many years that there might actually be deeper truth to the framing of reboot, even though it was coined 12, 13 years ago when I probably was 20, 21 years old and probably had no clue why we were framing it like that. In the beginning, it was just a way of, you know, Reboot was the annual day where we rebooted ourselves. But there's a lot of truth to how rebooting is not really about changing things just a little bit, but really booting them up once again and taking them in a whole new context. I'm a kid of the web. In fact, in a couple of days, I guess in 3 days, I have my 15-year anniversary as a professional working with the web, which is a bit scary. At least makes me feel a bit older, but I guess that's okay. What's always been interesting with the web for me has been that we always treating this as just new technology. And for the first many years of the web, and still in many instances, we're actually describing it as something new, but it's very old what we're doing, and we're basically just changing the existing behavior just a slight bit from physical to digital. Even the whole framing of digital and new media and interactive, digital marketing, okay, we do the traditional marketing, we just do it digitally. And in a lot of instances, I've become very frustrated and depressed about what I was doing, and and the web and where it was taking us. What I find very interesting at the moment is, from a technology standpoint, nothing is really new. All web applications, the open source stacks, everything is sort of, you know, is there. Everyone can build anything. But what's really changing is behavior. What's really changing is how we're acting, what we're believing in, what we're trusting in, what how we believe the world is set up. And at times, that's really scary. And it's very comforting for us to go back to the traditional stuff at times, because looking out there of what could be and the other side is always scary, and it's always a trade-off, and it's there are commercial, pragmatic reasonings to be taken, etc. So we now and then prefer to stay in our little comforting box that pats us on the shoulders and tells us that it's okay. Our industry organizations are established in the field. Everyone can pat each other. We're all having a jolly good time. What's really been interesting with Reboot the last many years have the lowercase Reboot, not the concept of rebooting, the Reboot Festival, have been this sort of journey of really trying to figure out what's going on and where the web is taking us. What is it we really want to do with this? And obviously, there's a lot of deep fingers and Bucky and Doug Engelbart and all these, Kay, Stewart, Brand, etc., all these great sort of countercultural people and a lot of these progressive ideas that actually aren't in the code and in the software and in the ideas. And really looking at the ideas and not the technologies is always very interesting. For me, the story has always been sort of about the web, that it's sort of the enlightenment period of coming out of this industrial, commercial consumption culture. The culture that was about doing more of the same, improving input and output capabilities, effectivizing that whatever you input is comes out in the other end, really making things more simple for the benefit of really being able to mass produce a lot of stuff. You know, the industrial age brought us TV so that we could be marketed to. It brought us brands that became a religion in themselves, etc. But really, it's sort of getting out of this sort of 100-year-old period that, you know, made a lot of sense for the time it was in. But it's sort of time to move on, and the possibilities are there. If we're looking at it, just one square centimeter in this great ecosystem, in this photo here, is you know, multiple times more complex than the processing plant that the 4T production plant, right? It's so complex systems intertwined with each other, not really being able to figure out. It's the photo of the little spaceship we're on. And it's the deep connection that we're really interconnected with everything else. The whole industrial thinking was about disconnecting things and making them work in one little context. Now everything is about connecting things. A lot of that obviously deals with the fact that we are connected, and we're often forgetting that deeply. All these cables, all these ships that have brought these cables, all the minds that now are connected, as some of the previous speakers have been speaking about, all the ideas, all the people that are connected, is really, you know, just the feeling of connection you have these days, that I'm always able to connect with things, with other people. I'm nowhere at any time, you know, not connected, and obviously has implications, as the previous speaker spoke about, has really given rise to a variety and a wild sort of changing period. When I was 15 years ago, I was still in high school, gymnasium, and it was about summer. We've been running this internet company, doing the first web pages, the first media, the first search engine, etc., in Denmark. And it was about sort of June, and I sort of needed to decide on whether to go back to high school or not. And I'd been sort of reading a couple of books, etc., and at some point I sort of had the idea that this was probably a pretty unique moment in history, that I sort of always could finalize the last year of my high school. I've been on leave 15 years since that, and never returned, really. But that's another story. So if we're looking at it, we're having all these wild implications, all the wild trends happening at the same time, and we're very confused. Christian touched about that in some regards in terms of the music industry and what's up and what's down. Really, you're looking at things where you really need to just to go out in them and try and explore them and figure out, and I guess that's sort of the common thinking of this event and the people that are here. Obviously, a lot of it also ties in with sort of just the belief systems or the visual icons we have of our ages. As the iconic photo of Earth from outside, sort of 1968, you know, people's movement, a lot of shifting to individuals, a lot of organic Earth whole systems thinking brought upon by that. We're all feeling the systems are really working in a networked operating model that's decentralized or distributed, whatever it is. Some instances very centralized, as the Protonet guides touch a bit on, which obviously is an issue. But really just this very interconnected system of individual nodes and really just trying to uncover what that really means for us. I haven't figured it out, at least all the playing rules of these network systems, and we're still seeing sort of, you can almost see all the traditional systems running on the operating model to the left here, you know, and every sort of reality playing the games or playing the rules of the systems to the right. And that obviously gives a lot of friction, and we certainly are feeling that at the moment. There's not a lot of systems in place in governments, in democracies, in media that makes a lot of sense for the times we're in. That's just pretty natural. It isn't really any big ideological fight necessarily. It's just what really made sense in the current context. So if we look at rebooting or reboot, I'm obviously then not thinking of the lowercase reboot, the festival, but the capital R reboot. The term reboot obviously has a lot of origins from bootloaders, from booting systems. And what I really sense that we're doing is that what we're doing are to reboot things. We're booting them up, you know, starting the systems up, we're acting, we're doing stuff, but we're also rebooting. We're booting something that existed. And this is a very important sort of distinction. We're not just changing things just a bit, we're actually sort of taking the whole system down and booting it once again. And this obviously was a metaphor that, you know, I've always been like, yeah, okay, reboot, that's a funny metaphor of rebooting a computer. But, you know, if you look at it, a computer is really, especially like a, you know, Unix system or whatever, this very complex system of a crappy architecture that just works really well. So if you look at it, I sense that we're really rebooting systems, we're rebooting culture, and to many extents, we're also rebooting ourselves. The re part obviously then ties in with sort of a theme of the Reboot Festival a couple of years ago, which was Renaissance. It even shares the re part of it. And I think that's a very important insight into what it really means to reboot things. The definition of Renaissance is the reinvention of old concepts in a new context. You know, lowercase R Renaissance, not the capital R Renaissance time period. And why I think this is very sort of important is that we're coming from a culture of the new, where people are claiming things to be all new, brand new. Twitter is new, the internet, you know, sort of the computer, everything is new, new media. But what they really were doing was very old. So the Renaissance sort of viewpoint would always be that what we're actually reinventing is old concepts in a new context. You know, there's nothing new about humans having conversations, humans sharing things with each other. The marketplace, the social square, that we conducted business as individuals towards each other, we had conversations. Business wasn't just selling, marketing, it was really building trusted relationships. In the small old village, we all knew each other, it was a pretty open. If somebody was doing something nasty to their wife or whatever, the whole village would know about it just by the sheer sort of closeness, locality of the small villages. So what's really interesting with looking at things as a Renaissance is that you sort of take the out of it. That is, you know, it's nothing new. It's just a time period of 100 years where we did something differently. We all moved to the suburbs. We all put ourselves in small apartments where we don't know each other and our neighbors. We all go into shopping malls or shopping stores where we don't know anyone. We just go in there, and it's all designed to go in and out, and then we do the transaction at the moment. These very inhuman experiences that worked for a great period of time, but you know, it's not really new that you're actually having a conversation with the cafe owner. You might even consider the cafe owner perhaps your friend, even somebody you actually know about your family and stuff. People look at that and then they're like, why would you want to know your cafe owner? Why would you want to share anything with the world? Why would you engage in conversations? You've got to be crazy. And obviously, coming from a sort of consumer culture, that is crazy, that we're just not just sitting flipping the TV switch, buying more crappy products, spending more money, and stuff like that. So a lot of this, I guess a lot of people, you could say, for many years, Reboot and the Reboot Festival sort of felt as this refugium for weird people that really felt that we needed to reboot things. And it was sort of this pseudo-academic journey into trying to figure out what was going on. But then sort of interesting things started happening. Once, you could say, was that that suddenly looking at things at rebooting wasn't this very weird niche where a couple of, you know, 500 people met up and shared their ideas about it. But rebooting things was suddenly mainstream. One enlightenment for me was that, because I'd never wanted to look at the metaphor too highly, but then one day I was sort of, it dawned on me that, you know, we all know from computers, things really need to crash before we reboot them, right? Your computers get slightly getting more and more slower. You know that it would probably be a good idea to reboot it, but you really don't do it because you still have 13 apps and 18 tabs open, and you know it'll take some time. It would be a hassle. You would need to boot up things and open and start to come back where we started and do things, etc. But if we look at it, things are really crashing at the moment, and you know that's just the last 24 or 36 months of time period. Our economic system has crashed. Our media system is crashing. Our democracies are crashing, and most unfortunately, our planet is crashing. Whether it'll crash in 5 years or 20 years, we don't know, but it's really crashing, right? So we're really sort of, it's suddenly very, you know, iconic for everyone. Whole system thinking about having this sort of sense that this really doesn't make sense is suddenly mainstream, because it's also us that are crashing, you know. I see people in the worst recession in 100 years resigning from their corporate job to live out some dream they have. I've never seen that in a recession before. In a recession, people are meant to be scared. They're meant to try and keep their jobs. Why would you, you know, give up your job at the most fragile moment in time? There's not just a lot of that stuff that's making sense for us. So if we look at it, So if we look at it, it's really interesting that this went from being sort of a geekiness rebooting whatever to the New Year's column in New York Times by their most influential columnist Friedman, who says it's time to reboot America. What he actually means is probably not really as radical as what I'm describing as rebooting, but. And he also knows it can't be done, but that's another story. People are starting to talk about rebooting Britain. Big conversations, big events, official papers by government agencies saying we should reboot Britain. And they're actually pretty progressive in terms of what they really want to do. So the times, they are changing. And our problem, or our opportunity, depending on your mood of the day, is that we basically need to reboot everything. You know, there's just not a lot of stuff that makes sense. If we look at that, that's obviously quite a big challenge, to say the least. What's the good part for us, and what we should be happy about, is that a lot of the patterns are there in our worlds, in the worlds that have been about understanding these things, about human-centered thinking, about open source, free software, about creating and making things instead of just consuming it. And there's a lot of patterns in play that seems to be working. So what's really interesting is us suddenly going from seeing ourselves as just designers that are for hire for the industry, or we're just people building websites, you know. In the .com bubble, we had this conversation, a couple of people, and I was sitting one night drinking beer, and we're like, the only thing we need to do, the only thing we know how to do is to build websites. And we were very depressed for 10 minutes. And took a, you know, a pint more, and then suddenly it dawned on us that, you know, actually everything was websites. If you wanted to reinvent what a bank was, it would be a website, right? You know, it would be running that code and that interface, and would be that kind of social platform. So it sort of was, we might not be that fucked that we thought we were. So what I've just briefly would want to do is to run through some of the patterns, some of the building blocks, some of the stuff that we always seem to be toying with in these systems that seems a bit far-fetched and a bit far out there, but that we're always sort of trying to balance and trying to get right. And some of you will see them as themes that have been explored at Reboot before. The first thing I think we're really seeing and really trying to understand is just a human mindset. And that's obviously pretty abstract. But really, all the excitement today are about what individuals, what human beings can do. Human beings are sort of becoming the operating model of the world. What can human beings collectively do? And once again, that really isn't new. But there's, you know, just been this great big fascination with big machines, big corporations, big brands. And nobody's really excited about that anymore, right? Everyone are excited about small machines that one individual can own and operate and do stuff with. We're interested in what human individuals collectively can do. 10,000 person corporation, you know, there's really no excitement in becoming bigger. We're sort of paying the price of all that's been happening the last 30, 40 years and the dehumanization of all that. So we're really exploring, you know, all the directness between human beings. It's not about transactions, it's not about commercial agreements. Most business was always done on a pretty human basis. But what we're really seeing with all the sharing is just basic human connections and human relationship building. Also, the human standpoint or the human perspective is interesting as the decentralized thinking of, you know, all the decentralization of tools that have been going on the last couple of decades, you know. Marx would call it that humans now actually do own the production tool, probably. You know, the computer, our fab lab tools, our tools for creation are unprecedented in their capabilities. So it's really about, you know, seeing it as human, seeing it as also, you know, not necessarily rational behavior. I'll give you an irrational behavior in the end. But you know, we just have really basic other assumptions about human behavior than self-proclaimed perfect systems, right? You know, it's like, oh, that's just Thomas, he's a human being, he can make a mess, right? But every time that our big corporate system makes a mess, you know, it's a big problem because we're believed for it to sort of be industrially perfect. Obviously, it also means a great deal for us as designers, as creators, and there's a lot of this stuff we really haven't figured out. One example could be sort of the design field of social design that some of us have been exploring for many years, of how to sort of really work out designing for many-to-many systems of individual social behavior, humans acting in a social system. It's really sort of, you know, in game design, where that comes in, et cetera. You know, it's really not about the human-computer interaction, right? You know, that's sort of done. We sort of figured that out to some extent at least. sort of where, you know, stack-wise, we're getting up on the stack. Interaction design is pretty well-defined and establishes the patterns, the web of the design patterns. What we're really seeing all the interest in is how to do the social design of systems, whether there are events, whether there are web platforms, whether there are nodes that connects us, our wireless networks. It's all about what the objects, what the objectives are, and what the flows are, what it is we're sharing, on what level are we sharing, how do we build identity in the systems, how do we get our reputation in there, how do we treat relationships, how do we organize it ourselves. So some of these design patterns are very interesting, a lot of sort of stuff happening in this field at the moment. But it's all really about designing for human-to-human interaction or a sort of human-to-human many interaction, which is even more difficult. One other perspective that I find we're always struggling with, and a lot of the stuff I'm involved in, a lot of the consulting companies I see doing this, always struggling with this, is basically, you know, that we're going from a perspective of consumption to a perspective of participation. The problem is for any organization is that, you know, we want to be consumers of your stuff most of the time, but then suddenly we want to be participants. But we're really not respecting designs or organizations as we did before. Any 18-year-old will send an email to the CEO saying, blah, 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 all this you're doing wrong. I'd be happy to come for a meeting and explain to you how you should really be doing it. We're not really, you know, we see ourselves as participants in the game, as participants in the process. We don't just want to be somebody that's acting in the system. We can't really play with it or mess around with it. So what we're seeing here is obviously a lot of work in this field of, you know, how do we really do these architectures for participation. Russ Mayfield's great work here and looking at some of sort of basic power law viewpoint of participation architecture. But really, how do we build these systems that sort of are participatory and sort of emergent much more than our current system thinking of traditional corporate organizations or just sort of a consumer experience? You know, when I'm in my supermarket, I might have an idea for a product. Where can I give the idea? I can't. You know, I might think something is wrong in the store. Where can I do that? I want to participate. I want to engage. I want to do stuff with it. I have a self-interest in this system working, so I want to be able to try and steer it in the direction that fits me. Another pattern that we're seeing that we're always toying with is obviously open or openness. You know, are we, you know, sharing openly, being open as individuals, being open for everything, like going to Hamburg on a Sunday afternoon, open to change how we see things or how we act, open architectures. And, you know, a lot of this, obviously, you know, open source as the consumer marketing-friendly version of free software, it's really sort of what we're always toying with. The whole bravo about Google Buzz at the moment deals with, you know, okay, how open are we, at what point, and have we decided ourselves, and do we really understand the implications of being open? But what we're really seeing is, you know, just a massive shift from seeing ourselves as closed individuals to seeing ourselves as open individuals. Somebody called this Mike Dale's law, you know, whatever, everybody needs their own law. But this is just a very short blog post I did a couple of many years ago. But just sort of this basic understanding or the basic insight that, you know, we used to be closed by default. There were very natural reasons for that. You know, the whole idea of communication or the communication part of your organization is where somebody that at some point choose to communicate. At a cost a lot of money to communicate, you needed to print brochures, you needed to buy stuff, you needed to do stuff. You know, so there's a lot of sort of just basic economic thinking and cultural thinking to it. What we're seeing now, or at least where things are trending towards, is that we're open by default. Obviously, at some times we're closed, you know, privacy implications, do I want to check into Foursquare if we're just doing something with a new organization and I need to wait 5 days before it's announced? No, I don't check into Foursquare then. So So it's not a utopian transparent society vision. But what we're just seeing is basically because of digital sort of basic economic realities and cultural realities of the participatory systems, it just makes more sense to be open. I want to share, I want to engage. So when looking at all this sharing that's happening, you know, people are always looking at it, why would people want to share something? It, you know, what do they have to say? You know, why would they want to share their files? Why would they want to share the music? Why would they want to share their knitting patterns? Why would they want to do a weird podcast and share that? We're always sort of seeing it as you know, trying to be more open. And it's just, you know, from basic networked understanding, you know, that any network system that doesn't have a central node needs to message and communicate and signal to the other parties in the system at all times, because else we can't operate, else we can't move, else we can't change, else we can't transact, else we can't make things happen. So it's really just basic, you know, openness, open architectures that's always very interesting in terms of how we're working. But, you know, it's always a design point when you're doing anything. How open is it? Are people ready to be open? I always describe Facebook as this great Trojan horse that took, you know, basically in a country like Denmark, it's taking 60% of the population to being sharing and open. And then when they had them all on, then they flipped the switch to really make it open, which you always discuss for a variety of reasons, but it is a very interesting point that, you know, blocking was something, you know, ooh, you were this niche defined. You even defined yourself as a blogger 10 years ago, right? Or I'm mo blogging, photo sharing, whatever. And today it's like, you know, everyone does it. You know, it's totally mainstream. All this, and that's just flipping, you know, in 6-8 years, which is really, really interesting. Another thing I sense we're always trying to figure out is trust. And I won't spend much time on this, but just we're, you know, all trust indicators goes towards trusting other human beings, mostly also because a lot of the system tries to present them as being imperfect. But in a world where you in 2 seconds can Google everything, or 1 second even, you know, it's really easy to figure out that the world is more complex than that, and there are other realities than what the company presents you with. So what I think is really interesting that, you know, we're basically building human trust again, because we've been taught not to believe in other humans because they were irrational, they weren't to believe, they had weird ideas, we really couldn't do anything with them, and we should believe in the systems, these very centralized systems we have been up and running. So what I sense we're doing always with an event like this or a bar camp, or I was at this great Christmas lunch, Twitter thing in Copenhagen where nobody knew each other and it was just this really beautiful 60 people, beautiful people, really acting in beautiful ways and really being open, really sharing everything. And I guess I tweeted or something like the other day, like, the, you know, the world will be revolutionized one Twitter Christmas bash at a time, or one round shift at a time, etc., that we're rebuilding this idea that we can trust in other humans. I always love this great quote by Jimbo Wales. That's sort of also a very interesting design point, because we're always designing from, you know, CMS. You know, when some of the first CMSs came out, it was this great empowerment idea of making it easy to publish things on the internet. Then in 5-8 years, they were totally wrecked by corporate thinking idea that it was about controlling who could do what and workflow and all that stuff, which you obviously need some level of, etc. But, you know, how do you really just, you know, build architectures that are open for trust to be created, as opposed to taking trust away to begin with? Last pattern is free. Free as in everything free can be. Free software, free as in free beer. Free as in being, free as an individual human being. I think I always sense that, you know, this is one we're playing with. You know, the Protonet presentation was just one big pitch for being free and self-determined and being able to do your own thing, right? Just really this massive perspective shift of going from sort of a gatherer society where we're collecting things and we're afraid, you know, post World War sort of syndromes, Cold War. We need to build assets in our houses if we can't get food for a week. We need to be protective. We need to be in the boxes. We need to feel secure compared to this sort of just wild hunter, in the forest-like style that we have today. We feel secure. We feel that, the basic human needs are being met. We feel the need to really be self-determined, not to be gathering objects. We're throwing away all our old objects, our books and all that stuff. We're finding ways of not having an office. Why have an office if you're always on the hunt? We're out hunting at all times. Do you want something to eat? We'll go out and hunt for something to eat. Are we out for new ideas? We go out and hunt for new ideas. So really just massive perspective shift of living in the moment as a compared to and being in flow as compared to sort of being about collecting and organizing things. I think the design pattern of the flow of the Facebook stream, the Twitter stream is very iconic, that it's about hooking into the flow, and then I might be away for a week and I'll hook into the flow again. It's sort of in and out hunting experience compared to the sort of store forward of email or the whole sort of idea of asset management or I'm collecting my things. If I live in a world where I can find the thing again in 2 seconds or I'll find something else that's just as good, I don't need to really collect it. I'm just living in the moment. Free obviously also ties with stuff that is free as the great sort of enabler or in sort of ideas or property or objects that all also are free, coming back to the music sort of argument of copyright and everything. So how do we really make things free enough and how do we make the trade-offs there is sort of a constant battle that's very interesting. So what can we do with all this? How can we act? What can we do not just to do motivational talks or sit and drink beer and have funny ideas, but actually doing something? I always find it sort of, I'm a practical guy, so that's sort of by inherent nature, that's what I'm always thinking towards. Many years ago, we had this brainstorming session, and I think it was David Heinemeier, Hanson the Rails guy, that coined this, but I'm not really sure. It was a very collective creation experience, where we coined this that sort of the Reboot Festival was for practical visionaries. I've always hated the visionary part of it because it's sort of self-congratulatory. But I believe that sort of having a vision, if you take it as that and not being defined as a visionary, it makes a lot of sense. How do you really have that vision and get going on that path, but being very practical about how you do it? And once again, we need to reboot a lot of things. So the time is now to actually do it. Right? We can sit on our laps, but we need to get practical and get going. One perspective that I will always enjoy and sort of based on a lot of good stuff by Doug Engelbart has been sort of the idea of the bootstrap. Because it's sort of, it's not, once again, it's Renaissance, it's not new, it's how things always have been created, not just the last 50 years. Because there you had massive big organizations that could make big goals and big initiatives and commit to doing things in 12 months, or, getting 1,000 people to work on one thing. But it's always been a bootstrap. How do you get the snowball running down the hill and getting the project to get bigger, getting, sort of up by the straps of your boots, Munchausen, where I guess a part of the framing is. How do you build the system? How do you boot up the computer if you can start by only doing the bootloader and then be able to load the operating system next? How do you really go sort of acting, taking the practical approach of actually doing something, taking that baby step, and, by taking that baby step, you're able to do the next step. Taking what you've got instead of dreaming about all the stuff you'd need to actually do it. I always sort of see presentations or pitches where, I just need 500,000 euro, then I need to hire 10 people, and then I'll do that, and I'll do that, and I'll do that, and I'm like, okay, but why don't you start doing it tomorrow and do the bootstrap on it? Obviously there are things in life that requires massive amounts of money, or at least that's our thinking. my great hero at the moment is a guy in Copenhagen that's building his own spacecraft. He started by building a 12-meter-long submarine. Then he built a 23.8-meter-long one, because international regulations requires any ship below 24 meters not to apply to any regulations. So he is a working 23.8-meter-long sub. He's been inspected by the U.S. military, because they were a bit frightened about if some guy in Copenhagen with no money at all, just totally bootstrapping it, building everything his deal, could do it. So after doing that, he had the idea that he wanted to build his own spacecraft. They have the engines up and running now. They're testing them at the moment. This summer, they'll do the test firing of the rocket. And it'll be a very small rocket, 12 meters long, 2 meters in diameter, with him and a glass bowl on top, standing up. Because that, you know, then you don't need to build a very big spacecraft, because you're basically just standing there. And as he says, he's a great culture jammer. He, you know, he totally does it to inspire of what can be, and obviously also because he wants to do it. But you know, he really sees the implications. He's not only sort of geeky of the technology of it, but he really. So this is basically a 300,000-400,000 euro, if they had to pay for it, spacecraft building. They'll go up to 100 kilometers in the atmosphere, just like Richard Branson's and the Virgin aircrafts and all that stuff. So actually, you know, you don't even need a lot of money or big plans or massive organizations to build a spacecraft or a spaceship. That's, you know, always pretty interesting. But what it does require is to stick it around. I always love this slide of, you know, I always ask people in corporate organizations, so when would you have killed the project? This is the evolution of the amount of contributors on Wikipedia from July 2001 to June 2006. And most guesses are within 18 months they would have killed the project. But obviously, as human individuals, we have the ability to stick around a bit more and the self-determination to actually do it. But it does require a lot of commitment to do it. So one request before summing up is that we actually have very few stories about what the world really is out here, if we inherently believe that we need to reboot things, and that we would leave a lot of the building blocks that they're free, open, human, etc. Even the sci-fi guys, they've stopped writing sci-fi because they can't come up with anything. Bruce Sterling has become this great eco jammer, object, product design guy, which is slightly interesting. Sci-fi has given up. That's at least what I'm thinking. You know, where are the whole visions? Where are the whole pictures? Where are the whole stories about, you know, what life will be in 10 years? What's really interesting is I have no sense myself, and nobody really has. So I think it's about time to really drive, you know, sort of write up some of these visions that are, you know, not technology oriented as old vision videos, or are, you know, necessarily a negative story. What if it was a positive story about how we really rebooted a lot of things, got the planet back in shape, booted up again, ourselves, our organizations, our daily lives, our work. So to sum up, I think there are a lot of patterns, there are a lot of building blocks, and it really doesn't, you know, you can always sit down and look at any system, and based on sort of the perspective of, you know, all of us, you know, you can pretty quickly come up with, you know, how to make it free, how to make it human, and how to make it participatory. You know, it's not that really that difficult. I spend a few hours a month doing, working with the Social Square social consultancy that I've co-founded, and you know, you can basically do it in 30 minutes with any organization, but you know, then implementing it is obviously a bit harder. So what I urge you to do is really to try and imagine of using the perspective of rebooting things, and just instead of just sort of playing the new game, trying to reboot everything, life, work, play, passion. it's always a hard trade-off. I had the last few years, I've had big dreams of reinventing basic education, because my older child was starting is starting in school this summer, and it's like, you know, I've just had to accept that, you know, I can't pull that one off. You know, we thought about buying a bus, and we had all friends lined up, 15 people. We would want to create our own school. It wouldn't have a physical, they would always be driving around all these small kids with their laptops, exploring the world, actually going to the science sites and to the real place instead of sitting boxed in 45-minute time cycles at a time, you know, the industrial, being indoctrinated to industrial thinking of, you know, now it's a break, but I was in a flow. No, it's a break, you know, all that stuff. But, you know, I just have to give up, you know. I really can't pull that one off. So he's dying in school this summer in a pretty standard school, which, you know, perhaps let's see if we can pull it off. It's always a trade-off. But what I find is really interesting is really trying to apply it to all parts of your life, you know, not having the corporate shitty job and bitching about that, but really, you know, trying to make a living out of playing with these things instead of, you know, just dreaming about them at night. It's hard, and, you know, you need to make trade-offs, but it's what I really think will take us there. So imagine what would happen if we came together as a participatory culture. Bloggers, culture hackers, designers, programmers, curators, knitters, musicians, whatever, and not we're afraid of each other and try to find ourselves and say, oh, our little field is different, but really saw all the things that were common in this and all the patterns and all the thoughts and ideas that we've shared, that our craft was basically the same. And rebooted everything. What would happen? That's it.
Marvelous. Thank you very much. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for joining us for this trip for the past, 400,000 kilometers traveling around the sun. If you want to challenge Thomas, you can join us in, well, an hour in the parliament, if you like. Jetzt haben wir eine kurze Umbaupause, das heißt, Sie haben die Chance, nochmal nachzutanken an der Bar, und dann gibt es zum Ausklang noch ein bisschen musikalische Takte von Soul Steady. Herzlichen Dank.